Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guests tonight are Luke Fernandez, assistant professor in the School of Computing and co-director of the Tech Outreach Center at Weber State University, and Susan J. Matt, who is presidential distinguished professor of history at Weber State University. And we're continuing our conversation about their book, Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid: Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Luke, Susan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again about this book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like we could literally take every chapter of this book and do an interview about it. But one chapter really stood out for me as being emotionally important because of things that I've seen myself. And that's a chapter about awe. And because I do a lot of outdoors things, both teaching classes and leading trips, I've seen this thing where people are seeing their entire experience outdoors through the lens of their phone, and also insist on taking selfies at like sort of beautiful areas instead of just photographing the area. And I just sort of identified with awe. And one of the things you open with, that there was a person who wonders whether we are suffering from an awe deficit disorder. And we're more focused on ourselves and less concerned with the grand, sort of the grandness of the universe. How would you define awe?
You know, traditionally it was defined, when the word originated, as a feeling of, wonder mixed with fear, a feeling that gave you a sense of your own smallness in the face of larger forces. And it was usually forces outside and beyond yourself. So it inspired feelings of reverence, amazement, astonishment. And I was interested to find out the word astonishment meant thunderstruck, you know, something coming from outside of you and kind of laying you low and making you realize that you're not all powerful. And that was certainly a religiously infused feeling when the word was first coined.
Another word that I sort of associate with awe and wonder is hubris. In a weird way, is that sort of if you don't have enough of one, you're going to get into trouble with the other.
Yes, and I think we discovered that too. You know, in our book, we have a chapter, and we already talked to you about a chapter on pride and vanity, and the chapter on awe, which is chapter 5. In some ways, those two chapters complement each other. And, you know, we think these days, we worry a lot about whether our pride and vanity are more apparent, more manifest than they were earlier on. And that may have partly to do with the fact, with the possibility that our awe, our ability to be awed is diminishing. And the reason for that is because when we're awed at nature, awed at God, we feel that sense of being just dwarfed by the power of the universe, the power of God's, and it makes us more humbler. When we're not exposed to those feelings as much, then pride and vanity is more capable of growing in those circumstances.
It also seems that because of the electronic media like Facebook and Twitter, that when we have those moments of vanity, we're now broadcasting it all over the planet. So before, when you were vain, a close probably group of friends would probably realize you were a vain jerk. But now it becomes the way that we operate when we do things. We show everybody our food. We show ourselves in front of the Nike of Salmon Thrice. You know, our vanity is on parade around the world.
And the fact that some people do it then kind of raises the stakes for others.
That's right.
If you want to be recognized or have an identity, how do you do it if everybody's kind of normalizing this pattern of blatant self-promotion? It's really hard to exist in the digital world unless you're projecting that self outward and singing your own praises. unfortunately. Yeah.
I find, and you mentioned the myth of Icarus, and this idea of awe and wonder, and the problems that happen when hubris comes into play, have been of concern to the ancients, ancient Greeks in particular, where you have Icarus. And I hate to say this, but you might want to just quickly run over the myth of Icarus, because I don't know if people read classical references anymore.
Yeah, the story is told differently by different people, but Icarus was the son of Daedalus, and they were in Crete in the maze, and they were trying to get out of the maze, out of the labyrinth. And the way the story is sometimes told is Daedalus, who was Icarus's father, thought, "Oh well, if I fashion some wings out of wax and feathers, we can fly out of the labyrinth." And so he did that, and he cautioned his son, "You know, this is fine, but don't fly too close to the sun. If you do, the wax will melt, and your wings will fall off, and you'll fall into the sea." And Icarus, instead of following his dad's advice, is so enthralled by this invention that he does fly too close to the sun, and his wings do melt, and he does fall into the sea. And you know, there's different takeaways that one can take from the story, but one is that one is a lesson about humility: is don't transgress. I mean, metaphorically speaking, you get too close to the sun, you're transgressing certain boundaries. You're going into the realm of gods, and that's not where humans should stray. And Icarus performed that transgression and suffered the consequences.
It's this feeling of invulnerability too, that you know, nothing can harm me. There was just a film passed down Facebook 1 or 2 weeks ago of people getting out of their car and walking right up to Buffalo in one of the national parks. And you know, often these things have disastrous ends, but people just have this thing in their mind that they want to photograph the stuff really close. And I visited the national parks out west, and I've seen this behavior, and it never ceases to amaze me that people have no sense of that something could be more powerful than them.
Yeah, I think they become background props, you know? I mean, that this is going to be the greatest selfie ever if I've got this buffalo here. And yeah, he symbolizes power, but does he actually have it? I think, you know, I can contain him in the frame of my camera. And yeah, we hear a lot about buffalo gorings near us.
Now, the wonderful thing about your book is that you trace these issues through different technologies going up and through before the 20th century and into it. And in this case, in this chapter, you start with the telegraph in 1844, Samuel F.B. Morse. And it's interesting, the first phrase he telegraphs is, what hath God wrought? And what was the emotional reaction of the public to the invention of the telegraph?
There was great euphoria. You know, Morse and his investors are certainly eager to support and encourage that euphoria, but it seems like it was genuinely felt, and not just, you know, the result of some capitalist plot. Ministers around the country and, in fact, around the world celebrated the telegraph as this new technology that was going to bring world peace and unite the human race in harmony. And there was a sense that the power to talk across spaces was a divine power, which God had kind of kindly allowed humans to discover. And the fact that they could discover it and could figure out how to harness it was a sign that God had providentially ordained it. So they definitely saw it as this like line of divinity and this supernatural power that had suddenly become human power.
And you also mentioned how these inventions like the telephone and like the telegraph also then become metaphors, like prayer is God's telegraph. People think about actually telegraphing God or calling God on the phone. And actually, some of those stories last well into the 20th century, too. There was even a Twilight Zone about that. But there was this idea that you're still, you, although these inventions do amazing things, and there were high hopes for what they were going to do to society, you were still under the auspices of a divine power that was greater than yourself.
For sure. And people again and again, you know, invoke God every time they mention the telegraph, at least at its inception. And what I found so interesting was how many ministers delivered sermons about the telegraph, both its initially and then when the transatlantic telegraph was first created in 1858. There's a whole rash of sermons that come out. But I also found we found in people's journals and diaries that everyday people were writing about the telegraph in the same terms.
Now, where's the word sublime in all this? That was a big term during the Romantic era, which is earlier than this, than we're talking about, but it goes up into the 1800s. Is the sublime that sense of being in touch with the sort of the power of nature and God?
Yes, partly. There's a famous among scholars, The Technological Sublime by David Nye. He wrote it in 1994, which is basically a history of the feeling in the United States. And he tracks sort of the progression of people experiencing the natural sublime, which was similar to to awe, in the sense you were out there in nature and experiencing your sense of powerlessness vis-a-vis the powers of nature. And that sort of those feelings of the sublime gradually diminish or are eclipsed by the rise of the technological sublime, where we start to be awed not so much at our encounters in nature, but our encounters with technology and large engineering projects, the train, bridges, dams. So we continue to experience sublime, but there's subtle, but things change subtly across time in these encounters.
Is part of the reason that all these things that you talked about, the telegraph, the phone, these bridges and dams, they're human created. And therefore, we are ourselves creating things that make us feel sublime. Therefore, there's sort of a loss of sense of importance of the divine sublime.
Yeah, and I think one by one, we take these powers, which we had initially or in earlier generations had conceived of as beyond the scope of human power, and we incorporate them into what humans can do, and we kind of end up redefining what it means to be a human being over time, so that, you know, humans didn't have electricity. Well, now they do, and now that's normal, and now that's a human power. But at that first moment when people get electricity, there's this question, well, whose force is this? Is this the universe? Is this a divine force, or is this a human force? And we've naturalized it, so now it just seems like part of our powers, part of our lives.
Yeah, and the story is partly about, like you mentioned at the beginning, was partly about perhaps ADD or awe deficit disorder, that just the experience of awe is declining, but also perhaps the experience of awe is being transformed. And yeah, we still may be experiencing awe at technology, whereas before we were awed at nature. But that awe is a little different. It's now awe at our own creations rather than at the creations, at least in a less secular world, the awe at the creations of God.
It's amazing the power of what your phone is now and how it changes your life and the way that you look at what you can do. Now with your phone, which used to be anchored in the house, your phone goes with you everywhere. It can record sounds, it can record photographs, and it records yourself. And you can play games with it, you can do whatever you want with it. So you've got a little piece of awe-inspiring technology, but now everybody has it. And that has to have an effect on the awe that we feel. It's not as awesome anymore. It's just, you know, I want the latest upgrade. That's all.
Yeah, I think we interviewed a lot of people for this book. You know, it's not just a historical text. We interviewed our contemporaries, and I think one person that we interviewed, sort of striking and memorable comment, he likened the phone to sort of entering into a cathedral, sort of this window into an experience that was perhaps not accessible as broadly as it has now become, that this $100 device was this window into experience, or this portal into experiences that people couldn't have before. And so in that sense, it was very much a technology which provoked and allowed opportunities for awe to become more prevalent, more available.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guests tonight are Luke Fernandez, assistant professor in the School of Computing and co-director of the Tech Outreach Center at Weber State University, and Susan J. Matt, who is the Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University. And we're talking about their book. It's a really interesting and important book. Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid: Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Now, you also track that as the 20th century starts to kick in, there's sort of people start describing the exaggeration of the sense of awe. There was sort of a denigrating of the feeling, the sense of awe. Why did that come about?
You know, as more people get accustomed to having these devices in daily life, and at the same time as American culture is becoming somewhat more secular, a lot of people come to think, first of all, that the technologies aren't God-given, they're human-created, so they're not quite as filled with wonder and excitement as they once had been. But they also begin to think of the whole concept of awe as kind of a backward emotion, and psychologists, philosophers all say awe is a holdover from an era when we were kind of in fearful reverence of the universe before we understood its powers. And now we do. So if you feel awe, you're a primitive person, is how they spoke of it at the turn of the century. So awe falls into disrepute, and it's seen as a naive emotion.
And I think Max Weber, too, a famous German sociologist from the late 19th century, spoke of the developments of science and technology as effectively disenchanting modernity and sort of taking... it's revealing the truth about the world, but at the same time, it was disenchanting it.
Well, you know, you look at the discoveries in physics about how reality exists. You look at, the things that are being found at CERN and the discoveries about the universe as a whole, and it just sort of seems like, well, they're figuring it all out, and there's only a little wiggle room for something like, well, that's still weird, but you know, it's as if we've taken on the attitude that, yeah, we're going to eventually figure everything out.
Right, we have the right math formula, and it will just be, you know, broken down into simple equations, right?
And yeah, it's like an advanced level class in physics, and just take that and you'll be fine.
Doesn't leave much space for wonder.
No, it doesn't. And then there are people, and you mentioned like Ray Kurzweil, or Kurzweil, who talks about the singularity. And there's other people who are doing this who really are starting to suggest, well, we can actually transcend mortality via technology. And there are an awful lot of science fiction stories, TV shows, and movies that sort of are about that, about how AI is going to change everything and we're going to be able to transfer our essence into a machine and therefore we'll live forever.
Yeah, the invention of AI, you know, may be an important, or artificial intelligence might be an important sort of benchmark in history. That's one way of telling the story, but people who are really sort of enthralled by these notions like Ray Kurzweil might say, well, it's an important benchmark in the history of gods, you know, the implication being that once we invent AI or become immortal, we in effect become gods. And so this sort of philosophy, or sort of the way that Ray Kurzweil regards the world, which, you know, this sort of transhumanist philosophy, it's a plausible way of describing or understanding humans, you know, that we're always about trying to improve ourselves and always getting better and transcending our current limits. But at the same time, you know, it's in many ways sort of contravenes the lessons of Icarus, right, and all those Greek stories that caution humans to recognize their limitations and not to be not to fall prey to hubris.
Yeah, it's interesting because I interview people who are working in AI and in robotics, and their attitude is just let's go ahead and do it, and so we'll ask the questions later. And you get a real fear that, my God, we should be asking a lot of questions before we start developing this stuff any further, because it could really turn around and bite us in the rear end.
Yeah, and that's one concern we have, is that this sort of whole culture that's come into such full focus in the 21st century, but obviously has a longer history than that, that we're gradually developing a sense that we don't need limits on anything anymore.
Right.
And so the fears about AI are certainly born of this idea that maybe people who are developing things in, say, Silicon Valley really don't buy into limits. And you know, there are all sorts of moral questions about what kinds of beings we become if we think of ourselves as infinite and infinitely powerful.
There's a great quote at the end of your book. In this secular age, the definition of what it means to be human is no longer illuminated by a language that distinguishes between mortals and gods. And you have a great conclusion in your book, and you talk about the two of you are partners, they're married, and how you were originally drawn to the internet, but you started getting a nagging sense that you're missing out on something while you're looking down at your phone. Talk about that.
Well, you know, we like to start the day looking out the window, and our town looks out over the Salt Lake, and so we would do this and often listen to NPR and drink coffee, and then we started listening to NPR and drinking coffee and looking at our phones.
Whoops.
And, you know, maybe reading the paper all at once. And the sense that, well, we should be able to take it all in. Our minds are infinite. Ourselves are infinite. Our attention spans are infinite. We should just be able to allow ourselves to be bombarded by all these things. Eventually became clear that we were, you know, able to concentrate on very poorly on none of those things, right? that our attention was so fractured, and this belief that we somehow had infinite and limitless attention and cognition was leading us to a place where we weren't understanding much.
You talk about humanity now often has an unbounded sense of self, the right to unfettered anger, and that's another great chapter in your book, unconstrained self-promotion, and awe at our own transcendence. Taking a selfie as you achieve Sartoria, I'm sure would happen, is one of the things I expect to see next. How do we make room for awe anymore? Do we? Is there a way to actively do that?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there's the cliche tonics that, you know, we should venture out into nature more maybe move away from metropolises so that we can actually see the Milky Way, which is, you know, so often occluded by light pollution and other forms of pollution, and that might give us opportunities to experience awe more and maybe regain that sense of being dwarfed by powers larger than ourselves. So that's certainly one popular thing that perhaps we could do. Maybe it's also putting down our phones when we're actually out in nature. We have a picture in our book by Caspar David Friedrich, who was a romantic painter from the early 19th century, in which he portrays this human being at the top of a pinnacle looking out over this landscape. It's called I think Wander Above the Sea of Fog. And it's evoking that sense of the sublime, of people encountering nature. And but then this painting is reworked by a Korean painter, Kim Dong-kyu. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name. And it's the same painting. It looks like the same painting, but if you look at it very closely, the gentleman in the painting, instead of looking directly at the landscape, is now looking through his phone. And, you know, you can read that painting differently. I mean, is he taking a selfie? Is he taking a picture of the landscape? But, of course, it's asking of the reader, how does this rework our sort of experience or encounter with nature? Is it allowing us to remain, to still have those sort of, that kind of awe, that encounter of the sublime that earlier generations had? So, yeah, maybe it's partly going out into nature, and partly it's about making sure that we go out into nature in the right way and use our technologies in the way that if they're going to mediate the experience, that they still attend to the virtues of awe.
As you write at the end, our feelings are being shaped by carbon and silicon. This is an amazing book, and it covers a lot of ground. My returning guest tonight are Luke Fernandez, assistant professor in the School of Computing and co-director of the Tech Outreach Center at Weber State University, and Susan J. Matt, who is a presidential distinguished professor of history at Weber State University. And we've been talking about their book. I love this title, Bored, Lonely, Angry, Stupid, Changing Feelings About Technology from the Telegraph to Twitter. Luke and Susan, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.